Homestyle Green, episode 268. What is regenerative housing? G'day, welcome back to another episode of Homestyle Green. This is the podcast dedicated to inspiring people to make a better place to live. Zola Rose has a vision for regenerative housing, and using regenerative housing as a solution for improving communities and sustainability. Zola brings a diverse and international experience to Aotearoa, New Zealand, where she now calls Nelson her home. Real estate has long been an investment and a means of making profit in New Zealand, and Zola explains in this interview how this has tended to undermine the values that we should otherwise associate with where we live. Housing should protect, shelter, and foster community, but we've tended towards the commoditization of housing. I started out by asking Zola to introduce herself and give us a bit of an insight into how she got into doing what she does today.
I'm Zola Rose. I'm now living in Nelson, Aotearoa, New Zealand, and I've been here for 6 years, and I immigrated from South Africa, where I raised my children in a rural Zulu community. So I've actually lived in 12 different countries. This is my 12th. And so I have quite a multicultural background, and I also studied community development at the master's level. So my interest in, at the moment, my work, my main focus is with my social enterprise, Common Ground, which is committed to enabling and building the movement for more connected, affordable, and sustainable housing communities. And it comes to me from both, I think, a positive push and a negative pull. In terms of, I love intentional community. I grew up as a foreign service dependent in a form of intentional community. We were expatriates, but I would say growing up at the time that I did in the different countries, there was really an intentionality of us doing a lot of activities together, supporting each other. And I really liked that sort of more smaller sense of community that I grew up in. Even though I was moving every 2 years, whenever I arrived in a new place, there was a sense of really wanting us to feel belonging and to get going in all the different things that life offered. So it was, even though we were moving every 2 years, it was really just that consistency of being in community that I really liked, as well as in university when I went there. There was also a sense of intentionality of being really with each other in that, on that campus. And then when I lived in South Africa and I got to build my own home and live in what was sort of an emerging eco-village or intentional community in this rural area, I really loved my ability to create my own house and what was around my house, which was we were growing food and growing a food forest and using it to really be in harmony with the environment. And the intentional community part meant that there were others on the property as well. And we were all raising our children about the same age. And so the children were running in between the different families and using the outdoors to explore. And we'd take turns doing activities with the children, celebrations and all of that. So I really appreciated having that, raising my children in a place that I could call my own, as well as this community where we were, sharing and really intentional with the values by which we were living. So that I say would be the maybe it's more the pull side, you know, the thing that really interests me about home and home ownership and community and intentional community. And on the other hand, when I arrived to Aotearoa 6 years ago, I had this stark contrast. Although it's a safe country and, you know, it's beautiful, I found that the housing problems were so immense that my background in housing, community development, eco-village development, all of that was really showing me through a lens that I didn't think that most other people from New Zealand could actually see the extent of the problem. I was able to see it quite clearly given, you know, my years of studying this, and I could see all the problems and just thought, I have to actually now step into doing something about this housing problem. First of all, I didn't like to be a renter in the climate of what it was like to be a renter 6 years ago. It's maybe a little bit better now, but it was a terrible experience in all ways. It was a damp, cold, moldy house. I was told what to do all the time by the tenancy management, couldn't grow my own food. There was just, you know, inspections that I felt were invasive. And then I was realizing that my story was quite common. And I ended up wanting to buy a house, I found that the state of the houses were terrible for the prices that they were. And I had, you know, had trouble securing, eventually did end up being able to buy a house, but it was in a terrible neighborhood because of, you know, the fact that nobody else wanted this house. And then realizing, when my relationship ended and I had to go back into renting, it was even worse, like no place that I could find as a single mother with two children to rent that was affordable. And so, yeah, with my personal experience it compounded multiple times with this housing problem, I just really put full energy into how could I be a part of the solution. And that's when I created Common Ground as the social enterprise to be able to tackle all the different things that I have found to be both a part of the problem, but where I see the solution going with how we can do our housing better.
Yeah. You've alluded there to a few things that I was going to ask you about, which is what you see as the problems with the current housing market, particularly in New Zealand. You talked about how that affects particularly renters and people who don't have a lot of choice. Have you got any thoughts on how we've come to be in the situation that we're in and what the sort of genesis of some of those issues are?
Well, I'm actually working on a report at the moment on enabling collective housing for ethnic women. And so I have opened up a lot of the documents that do spell out the decades of problems that have been compounded now to date. So I have been referring to those policies and state and reports to pull out the information. We've got our recently released government policy statement by Housing and Urban Development, October last year. There's a lot of detail about our problems in there. We have a Stats New Zealand report called Housing in Aotearoa released in late 2020. A lot of the reasons why we've gotten to this point are in that report, as well as we had the UN Special Rapporteur on Housing come and visit us in 2019. She wrote a report outlines all the problems in that. We've got the How We Live document, which was released in mid-2021, that talks a little bit more to collective housing, but the problems that collective housing has, which then relates to the way that we have developed our housing paradigm to date. Brands has released an alternative tenure document, but it does outline the problems that being able to do some of those alternative tenure options have. And then the Waikato Regional Housing Initiative, because I lived in the Waikato, is putting together a data lake which catalogs all the problems. So it's my lived experience, my having worked with people in this space, but there's a lot of data that people can refer to. So I'll just go through some of the problems that I see in terms of where Common Ground is trying to make a difference and where I see us is going. So the biggest thing is around the paradigm. So the paradigm is sort of the narrative and what we might call as the truth of how we understand housing. And it's really that paradigm that needs to change. And that is changed through a consistent retelling of a narrative that is different, as well as having programs that support a new way. So one of the biggest paradigm problems that we have is that housing has been looked at and used as an investment and a commodity to make profits rather than being seen as a home that people can create to suit their needs for belonging and a whole lifestyle. So when we put profit as a precedent, it undermines the values that regular people have and the standards that they have for their homes and places where they live. So those standards could be around sustainability or around connection, around how they want to use the space around their house. And so, of course, that impacts on a lot of the quality that we have seen, the bad quality. And it also inhibits innovation because funding is supporting of the profit motive rather than of the community led. And so when people come with innovative housing ideas, they cannot find the funding to support it. There's that risk aversion. We also have not defined housing as a human right for many years. And so we don't have legislation that protects housing as a human right, nor the funding and the resources for that. We have a really big problem around having money towards being able to do housing alternatives. And one of the biggest losses of potential income is through not collecting capital gains tax. So these are unearned profits on housing that have just come from the market increasing, and there's no tax on those gains versus hard-working people are taxed quite heavily on their day-to-day endeavors of working. We also don't charge a tax on land. So we have this problem of land banking, which allows for the cost of land to just continue to rise, despite the fact that it's not actually having any value added to it. And in other countries, in Africa, they have a thing like if you don't use it, you lose it. So the community values land as something that belongs to the community, and that if somebody just is sitting on a vacant land, they're actually eventually stripped of the opportunity to have that land, and it's given to somebody else who will make use of it. So again, land, how we see it as a commodity or as like a value rather than a living system that has natural processes, ecosystem services. It has spirit, wairua, as the Maori would refer to it. It has its own essence. And we haven't valued land for the fact that it is a living entity. We've mechanized it, and we've basically just written it off as a cost rather than something that we need to work with when we are developing on land. And that that value around land is the other problem that we have. So when somebody who owns land, who's been land banking and is then given the development rights to develop on that land, they get all that value uplift that isn't then given back to the community, where the community has actually been adding that value to the, you know, to the things that happen around that land. So there is something called inclusionary zoning that is recognized in America. There's a big movement of basically when land is rezoned to be developed for housing, a portion of that has to go into affordable housing. Either the land is given for affordable housing or the money in the value of that land is given. We can see that the only working model of it in Aotearoa is with the Queenstown Lakes Community Housing Trust. And that has managed to develop hundreds of houses just because they have been using that inclusionary zoning. And that is something that, like here in Nelson, when I asked the council, why aren't they doing inclusionary zoning? They said they're waiting for central government to basically require it from the top. So, yeah, we're kind of waiting. Maybe there's other councils waiting, but it's a very important way to be able to get more land available. And we have too much land in private hands. So I helped to start the Community Land Trust in Hamilton, which is a way of taking land out of private ownership, putting it into public stewardship, and therefore it sits in perpetuity in public stewardship, and it's used for housing in order to be able to manage, put housing on this land where the cost of the land is not included in the cost of the housing. Thereby, the house is much more affordable. But when somebody sells that house, they have to sell it back to the land trust. So again, it's kept in the community for the community rather than just for, you know, investor buyers.
That sounds like there are some mechanisms that do exist already that are options for doing something different from the more traditional land banking development, selling to private interests. It sounds like there are some alternatives that we already have.
We do. They're very minimal. Like I said, Queenstown Lakes is the only one doing inclusionary zoning. Hamilton is the only one who's actually got a community land trust set up specifically for the purpose of enabling affordable housing. So we really do need to have these across the country in order that we're able to move a lot quicker. The other problem is we've only just now put into the government policy statement the term collective housing. Now, this is a large percentage of the New Zealand population. I estimate it to be about a quarter of our whole population that falls into this category of collective housing, which means that these are people who make just too much to be able to qualify for assisted rental, or which would be supplied by either government kāinga ora or the community housing providers.
Mm.
And they're making too little for the market to be able to buy into home ownership. So at least a quarter of the population sits being basically wage slaves or rent slaves, not able to make a move in terms of building up any savings, get their foot into the housing market, because there's not enough financial or policy mechanisms for collective housing, which basically collective housing is community-led housing. It's building houses by the people who are going to live there. And it's more with a sense of people wanting to have a little bit of shared facilities, some shared land, and have some say in how that community operates, with examples of that being co-housing, cooperative housing, community land trust, papakāinga, and eco-villages. So we've just now recognized that collective housing is something in this policy statement, but we need really now government to put its money where its mouth is. I've gone through the policy statement. There's a lot that talks about collaborating with community and community organizations to be able to do housing innovation, but yet we don't yet have the government backing that in terms of government underwritten mortgages, which the community finance and the Housing Foundation talk quite a bit about that backing with government funding. So yes, we do have it recognized, but we just don't have the political will yet to be able to put the money in the policies where it needs to happen. We have too much of a risk averse, and we still have investors that we really need a more patient investor or an impact investor led in terms of our housing, because we still have talk of, but I want to see what my return on investment if I'm investing in affordable housing.
Yeah.
Well, the return on investment is all the other capitals. So we've got five different capitals, financial being one of them. We need to start looking at those other capitals as equally getting a return on investment. So those returns on investment would be your human capital, your social, your cultural capital, your ecological capital, and your built capital. So yes, you can get a return on your investment in those other four capitals. And we need to give value to that. You know, when we're looking at climate change and we're looking at gentrification and we're looking at, you know, issues of social isolation and mental health. And, you know, there's so many other well-being indicators that we need to say, yes, that's your impact. That's your investment. It's not going to be on getting 5% return or more. It's going to be return on people and on the fact that we've got a better environment to live in and the fact that we've got intergenerational well-being rather than child poverty.
And we need, so it's a much more, it's a much narrative. Longer... much longer term and more broad, holistic kind of outlook. I just want to pick up on the concept of collaborative or collective housing. How is that different from co-housing?
Co-housing is a form of, so collective housing means, you know, by the people, for the people. Co-housing is a form of housing. It's actually, you can have co-housing as what would be unit titles where people can own their own home, or you could have co-housing as a way of understanding how a community is going to be in relationship with each other. So you can have, for instance, a cooperative housing way of having the tenure, which is that you have a cooperative entity that people buy shares into, given permission to occupy a dwelling, or you can have co-housing where people are buying their house itself, getting a mortgage from the bank directly for that house. Mm-hmm. And on the ground, they look, if you were to take an aerial or, you know, a walk around view of a cooperative housing or a co-housing, they might look the same in practice, but it's the tenure model, you know, in terms of how they got their financing and the affordability aspects of it that would be different. But basically, co-housing is where people decide together the values by which they want to live in community together. There's that intentionality. And usually it's around the design of the use of the land as well. So there's clumping or clustering of houses together, sharing walls or closer together, thereby releasing quite a bit more of the land to either ecological, food growing, or recreation or common use facilities. And there's a it's usually of the building of the commons, the spacing and the infrastructure first, and then saying, all right, well, now we've got our common house, our workshop, we've got our parking lot to the outside of the property, we have our play area, we have where we're going to have our gardens. Now, where do we put our individual houses so that, you know, we're making now use of the other parts of the space rather than the way housing is normally developed is, well, where do I want to be? And then where's all my space? And then there's no collective spaces at all. And so it's coming from, you know, the collective good or the common good first and designing around that and then looking at, well, how much space do I need for my house? Because if I've already got an industrial kitchen in a place that I can entertain large groups of people, in a workshop space and a laundry that's shared, well, I don't need that in my individual house. And therefore, you have a different design of housing. But like I said, you can have that in cooperative housing as well, where the model is, the tenure model is different, but they still use. There's a really great community that I just found out, which actually does those two, the cooperative housing tenure with the co-housing design. It's called Chapeltown Co-Housing. It's in a very urban area of England. They're near the Lilac community, which is quite similar in its nature as well. So there's the Lilac and then Chapeltown co-housing. Highly recommend folks check out those two. Really good examples of both affordable as well as collective housing.
And of course, we've got some great examples of co-housing projects in New Zealand now. There's the Earth Song was one of the first, but we've got the Dunedin co-housing passive house project down in Dunedin, which is fantastic. And there's a couple of others have been inspired by that around that sort of model. The other concept that you talk about is regenerative housing. What's that about?
So regenerative is a broad term. I'm going to read a definition, which I think is really fantastic to give an understanding that it's a whole process of development that lends to very long-term results. So it's about seizing the opportunity born of crisis. So at the moment, we have a housing crisis, so it's looking at that opportunity of transforming our role as designers, planners, builders, and citizens. And it enables the places where we live and work to thrive. It works on potential in a way that creates greater vitality. It designs a built environment and human systems that can co-evolve with natural systems. It works to create fields of caring and commitment among stakeholders. It enables people to understand themselves and the places where they live as complex, evolving living systems. And it builds the political will and the systemic thinking capabilities that are required to design and create new ways of living in harmony with those systems. So it really takes a living systems approach and a systemic understanding. It's not a quick fix. It's looking at how do we develop the will and the wanting people to really see their role to play within that. And it's very inclusive. And that's what housing can be. So when we talk about collective and community-led housing, it's really taking that regenerative approach, involving people as a whole human being within the environment in which they live, which is a living system, and working with the complexity of that.
That sounds quite a philosophical idea, that quite conceptual. Is there any way that you know of measuring your success in regenerative housing?
Well, I would say to look at communities that would say that they are regenerative housing communities that have been around for a while and to see the success that they've had. So Findhorn has been around for about 60 years as a community. I would call it a regenerative housing community. And if you look at what they've been able to produce, not only for people who live there, but they've got, you know, learning centers and organizations, they have micro enterprises, they run training, they actually run the Global Eco Village Network, which capacitates this whole movement for eco villages around the world and regenerative development around the world. If you look at what's come out of that, sort of what formed originally as like a housing for people to live, that is a pretty amazing community. And there's another one that I like to look at as well. It's called Eco Village at Ithaca. They started as a way of with partnering with the university. So they had this sort of research, hey, how are we learning about what we're doing here? And then how are we sharing that with others? And I think it's 30 or 40 years on, they have got three different neighborhoods, done co-housing style. They have three different farms that they run on the property to teach and learn and do a community-supported agriculture. They're feeding hundreds of families from the food that is raised in that community. They are still working with the university in terms of bringing in people every year to learn about these systems of ways of building and growing and being in relationship. They work with refugees to help them get their market garden going as a business because they're able to use the land to teach and that for that purpose. And they've been able to influence quite a bit in the wider community of Ithaca where they're based in terms of really adding value to that regenerative conversation for the whole area. So I just think it takes looking at some of those examples. There's a lovely book that was written, 1001 Eco Villages, I think it's called, by the Global Eco Village Network, where they have so many different case studies of communities. Before the word regenerative was used, they might have just called themselves a eco village or maybe a co-housing or something. Now I think they're actually starting to put the term regenerative because we can see for the long haul that they have been regenerative. And that's how I would say is how you could gauge the success. How are what's the well-being of the people that are living there, of the environment in which they live, of the local economy, in terms of their emissions or the other ways that you can gauge different, soil or water quality, air quality, and then how it's impacted positively on the people that are in that surrounding community.
Playing devil's advocate a little bit, a developer of land might say that they're the ones taking the risk by putting down, getting a lot of debt, usually financing the purchase of a piece of land, then doing all the development costs, setting everything up. And there's quite a lot of risk involved in that. Because it's a long-term strategy, and they would say that they're actually contributing to the supply of housing. And some would say that their returns aren't as great as what they might be made out to be or just by looking at the increase in values of property. Do developers have a part to play in fixing the problem that you've identified?
Yes, I absolutely think so. But I really think that they do need the help of the government because there is a big risk factor, as you were saying. The governments don't want, the financial institutions are very risk averse. So there's a lot of interest and debt that is accrued in that process of getting consenting. So if somebody wants to do something, they have the land and they've started the process. Therefore, they start accumulating debt, and then the consenting could take quite a while. For instance, there was a really innovative housing idea that was in Northern Hamilton, and it really had so much potential. I think it had 1,000 houses, and they had taken all the values, you know, around ecological conservation and connected community and all of that. They would like to have some affordability in there as well. But the problem was that it was bordering on an industrial zoned area, and which was Fonterra, and Fonterra fought it for about 2 years. The fact that they didn't want a housing community anywhere in their area, even though actually it was nicely suited to housing in terms of where it was located in the city and for commuting, et cetera. And so that developer took quite a risk to put that together, then had to fight for 2 years against this being able to rezone it. And it made it incredibly affordable. So unaffordable. So how are they able to do now affordability when they've actually had 2 years of fighting to be able to get any consenting? So that's where we really need the government to step in. We need to look at what's the benefit to the people who are going to be living in that area and to the environment. And we need to look at that planning and consenting process that is going to take some of that risk and some of that length of time that developers sit with.
Yeah.
So that they're not eating into what they might be able to roll over into some affordability. And it's just eaten up in trying to defend their case or fight for what actually could be a shortened consenting. For instance, there's a woman who, my client, is developing an eco-village in Raglan. And an eco-village is a combination of housing with the development of the land into some ecological, agricultural kinds of activities. It's really a different kind of zoning. It is not housing only, and it is not agriculture only. And yet we sit with just those two types of zoning. So when we go to the district council and we say, well, we've got this great idea to be able to use the land and for people to live on the land and all these appropriate technologies, et cetera. And the district says, we think it's great. We see how it aligns with the sustainable development goals and other local organizations and the 10-year plan for the area of Raglan, and we're definitely in theory behind you. It's great, and you still have to jump through all the planning and consenting hoops as if you were like a conventional housing development. And we would just keep, but can't you? You've already acknowledged that we're not a conventional housing development, that we have much more positive impact that's going to come out of it, and yet you still want to treat it as such the simplified. And so I think we need the government really just to get more on board in all the different ways. In the How We Live document, it does outline the ways that government can support more the collective housing movement, but also the affordability pieces within that as well, because really developers are working within the confines that the planning and consenting and the RMA and those kinds of things are dictating that they have to do, a lot of hoops to jump through and a lot of price that is connected to jumping through those hoops. Yes, I think developers absolutely can play a role. There's this wonderful developer down in Queenstown. It's called Bellbird Development, Vicky Spearing. She's a part of my network. She had an amazing, she came on as a developer, had an amazing, beautiful concept for what she wanted to design. And then the consenting and all of that took that away from her. She said, I just could not afford to do what they were asking me to do, and all those collective pieces that I had built into the project that would have made it such a wonderful place to live, I had to take out and to be able to actually finally move to do something on that land. She was very disappointed.
I heard about that Bellbird. It sounded like an amazing project, and I think you're right. Yeah, you know, some of these things, the margins are pretty slim, and there are some risks. So any big hurdles that councils put in the way can derail things. And like you say, I think it's often those things that make it special were probably the things that come out first, because they're the things that the council is likely to be most risk adverse towards, because they don't have a box to put them in. There's nothing to tick that, you know, because it hasn't been done before. That's part of the problem of breaking the mold.
Yeah, another one of my colleagues, Ian McComb, he's got a development company called Small Time Development, because he was seeing, you know, the fact that people who want to do something different, it was taking them, you know, 8 or 10 years to make it happen. So he thought, I'm going to pilot, I'm going to make it happen. I'm a developer, I've got engineering experience, you know, worked in council. Even he had a beautiful design, I think it was in Featherston, where he was trying to pilot this idea of a, you know, smaller size, but more shared amenities and all of that. He's again had to scrap half of what he wanted to do in order to just move forward with being able to do anything. It's every time I speak with somebody who's trying to develop with any sort of innovation and set of values, each one of them has such great disappointment in the fact that they've had to give up what would have been a wonderful community development just to be able to jump through the hoops and not have it cost them an absolute fortune. Or incredible amount of time to do it. So absolutely, developers are the way, and they're not the problem. You know, I mean, there a lot of people are wanting to do things differently. I've seen it, but we just need the mechanisms of government to come up and meet the developers and say, hey, if you're willing to be a part of the solution, we really want to. And we need different categories of development, because the government doesn't recognize, even from a tax perspective, that if a group of people want to get together and form a development company in for the, you know, that process of development and then sell it back to themselves for that, you know, the individual ownership, there's all this tax implication. And groups are like, hold on a second, we were never a profit developer. We've only just been a collaboration of people, and yet you want to tax us like we're a company, but we're, so we really do need to look at those things, and quite quickly as well. We really don't have the time to sit and debate. I mean, I see how government in other places have made incredible mandates very quickly, transforming the whole way we operate as a society. And yet this housing crisis has been going on for 30 years, affecting, you know, I would say half the population in terms of our well-being. And yet we're not making any sort of strides at any sort of speed, where actually we have enough data. Like I mentioned, all those reports that have been written, we've got enough case studies of how it's being done overseas. There's actually no excuse not to be moving on it quicker.
I get the sense that you're pretty passionate and pretty motivated to help people make that change. And you have got some success stories and some services that you offer. Give us a quick rundown on how you help people.
Fantastic. So I have noticed that there's a lot of practitioners who sit within this space of wanting to do housing differently. And so I formed a consortium open to anybody who feels that this housing in service to life is something they feel called to step into. So it's a referral and collaboration consortium of professionals who have some housing and community development in some form of either regenerative development or permaculture or something like that. And it's a way for us to work together and support projects or apply for projects or offer each other support, advice, and ideas. Open to anybody to join that consortium. And I'm hoping that as more collective housing projects are able to come into startup phase, that this consortium is going to be able to serve these groups of people. And that's on the Common Ground website to read and join that. I've also created a bunch of services for people, groups, or even housing developers who want to be able to develop a housing connected, affordable, and sustainable housing community. I have an accelerator and mastermind program starting in April, where it's a group program where we're sharing our skills and knowledge and networks with each other. It's got an accelerator piece where we're going to be holding ourselves and each other accountable to quarter goals that we're going to be setting to advance our project ideas, as well as a course that's going to be offering the more technical aspects of community development, or property development, so people can really get both the theoretical and the support as well as the technical. So again, on my website, Common Ground, that's called Housing Community Creator Accelerator and Mastermind Program. I also offer one-on-one coaching and mentorship support if people don't want to be part of a group thing and just want that one-on-one. For women, I have the Women Revolutionizing Housing Network. It's free to be a part of it. I held a retreat in June bringing together women from around the country, and that was an amazing time that we spent together talking about our grief around how our country is in how we're suffering with our housing. And then we got together to say, right, all right, we're each stepping into a leadership role in some way to be able to advance it in our own community. So we're offering a monthly webinar series now. Our first topic is going to be on the 17th of April. I've got two women covering the topic of cooperative housing from an international perspective. We have Cooperative Housing International and Cooperation Housing from Australia to present. And then next month in April, we're going to be offering it from the local Aotearoa perspective. So it's going to be on the third Thursday of every month, so 17th of March and then in April. But sign up for the network, and then I send out emails about that. Just in general, if anybody comes and signs up for my newsletter, I try on a weekly basis to send some inspiration, case studies, maybe some law policies, ways of connecting. I'm always trying to inspire people to keep, you know, motivated that if they have a dream, it's something that they can pursue and find others. And I have resources on the website. So I know you asked if I have any like podcasts or books that I recommend. So my website, commonground.net.nz, also is like a repository as much as I can get to adding things to it. That is sharing these bits that people can access to be able to gain knowledge and skill to be able to, take on a collective housing project and find others to help them along the way. Yeah. I can mention some of those podcasts and books if you'd like.
There's a huge amount of I would just direct people to commonground.net.nz because you've got some great links, great resources there. And that's where I think people can find most of that stuff, including your YouTube channel and some links to some of the interviews that you've already done. But I think those services and it just sounds like if somebody is at all interested in any of this stuff that we've been talking about, if they're looking at a project or just wanting to do some housing in a different way, it sounds like you would be a great person for them to get in touch with.
Yeah, exactly. We can only do this if we're working together. It's too momentous of a task. So it's really about starting with connection. And then from connection, we can all get that bit more inspiration, support, and resource to be able to, you know, tackle step by step the project ideas that we have. And be that voice for change that we need to have it for this country. And I keep inspired by listening to podcasts pretty much every day. That gives me that feeling like it is possible. We will get there.
Yeah.
Connecting with the real community makes a big difference.
Awesome. Hey, well, thank you, Zola. Really appreciate your time and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for hosting me. I really appreciate it. And thank you for the work that you're doing to raise awareness of better housing in this country.
And that was Zola Rose of Common Ground, who is really keen on the term regenerative housing. And she's got a lot of solutions and she's helped a lot of people already try to navigate the policies, the local rules, building codes, to get projects off the ground that are a little bit different from the norm. And I think that's what we need, to innovate, to do things a little bit differently, learn from models that already exist, that have existed in the past and do exist overseas. We've got some great co-housing projects here in New Zealand now. I really like the intergenerational style of housing. I think we need more of that. And we could also learn from lots of indigenous community style of housing around central Marae, shared facilities, but still embracing some of the modern values that we have of personal space. I think there's lots of opportunities to explore ways that combine what we value today, but also what we know of from the past to really create healthy, vibrant, and sustainable communities. You can reach out to Zola if you'd like to learn more about what she does or work with her. Go to commonground.net.nz. I'll put links to that in the show notes, which you can find at homestylegreen.com/268 for episode 268. Thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, click on the Patreon button on the website at homestylegreen.com. Love to get your thoughts, feedback, and of course any contributions you can make to help support the show. Be much appreciated. And we'll be back again soon with some more inspiring people. In the meantime, go make a better place to live.